I will not read a poem that relates to the sovereignty of God or the fingerprints of providence, but I want to read a poem in honor of Mrs. Jenny Dietrich. Let me ask you a question. If and when you read those books like Fox's Book of Martyrs or some of the other collections of stories about the martyrs, and you read about a 17-year-old young lady who is tortured because she will not knuckle under to the state church and is burned at the stake, would you call a 17-year-old believer a saint? Would you call a would you call a 42-and-a-half-year-old pastor's wife a saint? Could you? Aren't we all saints? At least I thought we were. It's not really that hard, folks. This is, I'm not trying to trick you. Are we saints once we're saved or not? Oh, good. I was beginning to get a little worried there. Yes. So, Mrs. Dietrich would not have to be 85 to be a saint, nor that 17-year-old young woman who is burned alive because she will not deny her faith. Well, here's a poem called Dear Saint, and it's about a saint going home to be with the Lord. And I'm dedicating it to the honor of Mrs. Dietrich. Dear saint, lay down your load and take up rest. Welcome home. Sit down, ye blessed. Lay down sorrow. Take up joy. Put off mourning. Death can't destroy the seed of life that God doth plant. Death tries to kill, but finds he can't. You're not beneath corruption's sod. You're in the presence of our God. Bright day, dear saint, bright day. Dear saint, life's battle's won. The strife is done, the pain is gone. The race is run, the crying's through. All things new, a mansion now God has for you. Well done, dear saint, well done. Come, walk upon the street of gold. Come, hear the half that's ne'er been told. Come, stay a while with Paul and John. Come, meet the souls who've traveled on. Sweet peace, dear saint, sweet peace. And we know she's in the peace of our Savior right now. I do want to express appreciation to Dr. Beale and Dr. Comfort for having me back. Thank you. Jane and I found a handwritten card from President Beale when we stepped inside the guest room, and it's just so much like him. He gave us a very, very warm welcome, and all of you have done the same. I was helped by the ministry of Pastor Scott Hooks, Dr. Comfort, Pastor Mark Monty. And let me say something with respect to Brother Monty. Even before I became a Baptist, I always liked to hear preaching. We were reared just 4 miles from the Holiness camp meeting that was operated by our small Holiness denomination. And I've always liked to listen to preaching. And I think after these years, I know a little bit about preachers. And I wonder if you know. And I'm not bragging or trying to flatter him. We don't know each other well. I think I heard him preach once before here. I've seen him at a couple fellowship meetings, but that's all. I couldn't say that we've been close. But I wonder if you realize what a transparency. And yes, the word is humility. It took for him to tell on himself last evening about how he jumped to the wrong conclusions about that dear man who had lost his job that very day and wrestling with the future of his income and the family, distressed. Now, that took tremendous transparency for a pastor to tell on himself that way. And that was special. It was one of the most special times that I've ever had in listening to preachers. And I'm hoping that if you allow that there's even the possibility that not every preacher is that honest to make himself look bad. I've met dozens of preachers who would never tell on themselves that way because they're concerned about their image. So if the Lord lays it upon your heart, I'm hoping that several might get his address from Mrs. Conley and just write him a note. Now, that might not be the item that you would send her out, but I'm going to write him, and I'm going to thank him for his transparency in not making himself look good, but making himself look bad, that we might learn. I'm grateful for Brother Ream. Thank you, sir. Miss Wagner, all of you who serve in the music department. The music here at Ambassador is, first of all, Christ glorifying. Then it is excellent. It just is excellence. It's excellence, and then it has evangelistic warmth. And when you get that, you just can't go wrong. It's Christ glorifying. It is excellent, but it has evangelistic warmth. And thank you to all of you who have sung or played instruments. I'm deeply grateful. I'm grateful also to Brother Marco and the dining room staff, aren't you? Thank you so much to all of you who serve us in that way. And I intended to say this, and I'm getting to preaching next, but I intended to say this the first time we sang, O Triune God, please understand that there are three names on those song inserts. There are three names. A poet can write words. He can even try to write lyrics. But it takes the composers. It takes the composers to give the words wings. So thank you. Thank you very much, Brother Ream and Miss Wagner, for giving those words wings. All right, let's turn, please, to the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis again. Let's come in at chapter number 40, and verse number 1. Would you stand, if you're able, for the reading of the inspired Word of God? Genesis chapter 40 and verse 1. And it came to pass after these things, let's remember that Joseph has been falsely accused of serious impropriety, and he's been thrown into prison at the hands of a very, very angry Potiphar. After these things, that the butler, also a cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker, had offended their lord the king. These were two strategic officers. They were going to taste the Pharaoh's food and taste his drink to be sure that none of his enemies would try to assassinate him in either his food or his beverage. And both of them, they were high officials close to the throne. They both had offended their lord, the king. Now we're talking about the Pharaoh. And Pharaoh was wrath against two of his officers, against the chief of the butlers and against the chief of the bakers. And he put them in ward in the house of the captain of the guard into the prison, the place where Joseph was bound. Thank you for your kind attendance to the Word of God. Please be seated. This is the period of time during which author Don Anderson says, Joseph must have felt like he was on hold. Have you ever felt like you were on hold with respect to knowing the will of God and doing the will of God? But we need to remember there is no downtime in the providence of God. There's no downtime in the providence of God. Have you ever had a teller at your bank tell you that she cannot give you your bank balance because the bank's computers are down at the moment? I'm convinced that the one time a year I go to the bank. Jane goes back and forth to these places for me. I'm convinced the one time a year they see me coming, they just kick the computer and put up the sign, sorry, we can't give you your balance because the computer is down right now. There's no downtime in the will of God. There's no downtime in the providence of God. God put the cupbearer and the baker into the very prison where Joseph was. And only a secular humanist or an evolutionist would say that this happened by chance. And so here's the eighth practical application of the hand of God in the robbery of men, or the fingerprints of providence at work in our lives. The hand of God arranges circumstances to accomplish God's purpose. Romans 8:28 have been quoted several times this week. We know that all things, the wrath of man, prison walls, lies, slander, all things work together, are mixed together by the divine pharmacist. Like in days of old, when the old-time pharmacist had the mortar and pestle and would mix together several substances for the good. If he put too much of one thing, it could harm the patient. But the pharmacist knew just how much of what substance to mix. All things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to God's purpose. It may be that we're resenting the things that we're going through because we're insisting on our purpose for our life instead of bowing before God's purpose for our life. We need to surrender our purpose to the purpose of the all-wise God. When we do that, we place ourselves in a position where He can bless us. But He cannot bless us as long as we're trying to force our own agenda. We need to set aside our preconceived plans and ambitions. Paul wrote to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 12:6, and there are diversities or variations or differences of operations, but it is the same God which worketh all in all. Now, to you students who still don't see the pattern, would you at least be willing to say that much tonight? It's the same God who worketh all in all. Would you think that God would be so discriminatory that He would work in President Beale's life but not yours? God is no respecter of persons. He's at work in your life. Indeed, even though God has wonderfully used Dr. Comfort and Dr. Beale, God's just as much at work in your life as anyone else. Moody, Spurgeon, James Hudson Taylor. He's at work. Philippians 2:13 says, "For it is God which worketh in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure." Take this down, if you would, please, and trust the Lord on it. Please trust the Lord on it. Don't trust me on it. His pleasure will be your own best pleasure if you'll only give it time. His pleasure will be your own good pleasure if you'll only give it time and perhaps eternity. But somewhere along the line, you're going to wake up and realize, this is what I wanted all along. I didn't realize that this winding way would be how we would get here. But this is a settled piece in the will of God. He has not brought me by the way I thought he would, but this is it. I now recognize it's what I wanted and needed all along, but I did not see it back there. He works in us to will and to do of his good pleasure, which becomes our good pleasure given time and hindsight. Ephesians 1:11 says that we are predestinated according to the purpose of him who worketh all things after the counsel of his own will. No matter woman or child or teen is ever predestinated to heaven or hell, but we are chosen that once we do trust Christ, we shall be conformed to the image of him. That's his will for every believer. It's not a these to heaven, these to hell. No, he chooses us that when we are converted and born again, and it's not optional. For those who don't like the word discipleship, or, you know, I just don't think I'll live a holy life right now. You're casting aspersions on who your father is. If you're genuinely birthed, you know that the precious holiness people used to talk about the second work of grace and entire sanctification. And I'm afraid it gave some the impression that this is sort of a 2 or 3 or 4 step plan. And you escape hellfire the first time. And then if you choose, maybe you can have various degrees of sanctification. No, no, no. The moment you become a child of God, you're expected to start looking like your elder brother, the Lord Jesus. That very moment. Progressive sanctification. And so God is at work in the circumstances of life to accomplish his own purpose. Our human impatience, our captivity in the confines of time, our temporal frame of reference often leads us to overlook the fact that God is always at work in our lives, though he's in no hurry. You've heard about Phillips Brooks from Boston, big giant of a pastor. God used him to pen O Little Town of Bethlehem. And someone came to his office one day there in Boston, and Phillips Brooks was just pacing up and down, big fellow, just pacing up and down like a bull. And the person said, "What's the matter, Pastor Brooks?" He said, "The matter is that I'm in a hurry and God is not." But God is at work in our lives, and he orchestrates the developments and the experience of our lives so that we come to glorify Christ and find his plan for our life. God does not have to hurry. If biblical history and church history teach us anything, they teach us that one of the several schools that God insists that every believer graduate from is the school of patient expectation. You know, the earnest of the expectation. He puts us all in the school of patient expectation. He arranges circumstances and conditions to his liking, his perfect liking. Joseph may have felt that he was on hold, waiting on the providence of God. But in truth, God was already ahead of Joseph. Remember that the psalmist in Psalm 139 says that God besets us behind and before. God was not behind in this sense. He was ahead of Joseph and setting things up. He put Joseph there first, and then he put the contact man who was the key to the ear of the Pharaoh, the cupbearer. God was ahead of the whole thing. He's ahead in my life, and he's ahead in your life. Paul waited at Caesarea by the sea. King David waited in exile. The providence of God was at work while Abraham and Sarah waited or failed to wait and brought agony upon human history in the whole situation with Hagar and Ishmael. John Knox spent 12 years of his life in exile from Scotland on the continent. John Knox spent 19 months of those 12 years as a slave, chained in a French galley. 19 months! That's a long way from God using him to bring a flaming revival to Scotland. He must have thought that his passion for God was quite distant as he's pulling and pulling and pulling on the oars until he's so sore he can hardly pull one more time. Adoniram Judson spent 2 of his 14 years in Burma in a jail that was more like an animal cage. It was a cage that you'd keep tigers in. And members of his family would come and shove him food through the bars of the animal cage. And his captor said, "Now look, we can't let our Burmese people see his hands, because his hands are scarred and worn with hard work, and those are not the hands of a criminal. And if our people see Judson's hands, they'll know that we're lying and accusing him falsely. Never let our people see Adoniram Judson's hands." But he waited there in that animal cage. And here also is Joseph in prison in Egypt for 2 years while God works. Now come also, please, to verse 4. "And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them." He made Joseph responsible for these 2 recent prisoners. "And Joseph served them, and they continued a season in ward." Practical application number 9 is that the hand of God does not always work the way we expect. It might be closer to the truth to say that the hand of God seldom works the way we expect. The hand of God does not always work the way we expect. In fact, it could be said that God seldom works the way we expect. Pharaoh got angry with his chief baker and his chief cupbearer and put them into the very prison where Joseph was. Then the captain of the guard chose Joseph to serve the baker and the cupbearer while they're in prison. Joseph probably performed the menial duties of a valet. He may have shaved them. Nothing further on that. He may have shaved. You know, the thing today, and they're going to chase me off the planet. To beard or not to beard? That is the question. And if I ever grow a beard, and If I ever grow a beard, it won't be for all those spiritual, biblical reasons of Brother Reem and Brother Monty. Did you hear the list of all the spiritual reasons? If I ever grow a beard, it will be because I have an ego and I come to a conclusion that I'll look better. It'll hide something in my nose. No, really, I thought about 6 months ago I'd start to sign as my life verse. Selectively, of course, I would look up at the person asking for the signature, and I would sign in some cases, and Joseph rose and shaved himself. That's in the... You're not used to laughing with me. You come primed to laugh for Brother Monty, and I have to work like crazy to get the slightest grin out of you. Well, now, we got out there by saying that Joseph, as a valet, probably shaved these two bureaucrats. Shined their sandals, brought their meals, and that sort of thing. But let's pause here for a moment. And I've gone over this several times, and if I've got it wrong, I'm certainly not beyond correction, and I'd like someone to come and tell me. But we pause here to ask a question. Who was it that chose Joseph to serve these two out of favor VIPs? Who was it? It's there in four. Talk to me. Who was it? According to the first part of the verse. Who chose Joseph to be the valet for these VIPs? Who? We're looking now for a description, not at this point a name. Who? Captain of the guard. Now, I may have missed it. I've tried to go over it, Brother Spencer. And I really want to be told, because I don't want to read in just to, you know, people, oh, don't look too closely because that'll preach. No, if it's not here, I don't want to just do it because it'll preach. But unless there was a change in personnel here, you go back to 39:1 to find who the captain of the guard was. Would you go there? And Brother Bray, read out to me in 39:1 the name of the captain of the guard. We look at the commas. These words are in apposition. Give me the name of the captain of the guard. Pardon me? That's the way I have it. Now, please tell me if there's any indication in here that by the time we get to 40 and verse 4, tell me if there's a new captain of the guard. If there isn't, the same one chose him to be valet for these VIPs as got angry with him because of the lie of his wife. And if it is still Potiphar and Potiphar again, there's just something about the life of Joseph that Potiphar cannot let go of. In spite of himself, in all of his anger, he just cannot deny the God-given merit of Joseph. Potiphar chose him the first time when he selected and bought him from the Ishmaelites, 39:1. Now, unless there's something I'm missing, Potiphar is going to choose him again. He cannot resist the clean-cut integrity of Joseph. And that brings us to the tenth practical application. The hand of God can heal broken relationships and rebuild shattered trusts. The hand of God can heal broken relationships and rebuild shattered trusts. God can use the passage of time to clarify perspective. And I have a sneaking suspicion that the more the more Potiphar watched his wife, the more he began to see through. Because if Joseph would not come on board, she'd be looking for another candidate. Time has passed. A perspective has changed. Joseph, because of the Spirit of God, understood that time clarifies and time puts things in a clearer perspective. Joseph predicated his whole life on that principle. If Potiphar was willing to bear the hatchet and bump him up a little bit again, he's waiting with his hand out. He's not saying, not on your life. You didn't believe me one time. I don't want this assignment either. No, no, no. Come to the brothers. He's looking, hoping, and wanting to reconcile. The hand of God can heal broken relationships. This book that Dr. Comfort gave me, and I read the two chapters last night. Many of you here know the preacher. It's my understanding that he's now 97, that just released a few months ago, apparently. Highly respected, trusted as a man of balance, Christian sanity, and integrity. This dear preacher had his son, and I'm leaving names out, though I feel I would be free to give names because he's published it for the whole world. And he's being transparent too. And he says he was sometimes too busy. What about me? Pastor, father, what about you? He said, sometimes I was too busy. And I didn't do enough things with the children. But at a point, he had his son come back to take the music ministry of both the large church and the growing Christian school. Things seemed to be going well, but his son's mother-in-law, and please, this is not an attempt at humor, as much as I can piece together from some things I've been told and how it unfolded. Apparently, this preacher's son's mother-in-law was more moderate, closer to new evangelicalism, and she started to tell this preacher's son that his father had been too conservative and that they didn't want that for their adopted boy, whom, in fact, this preacher and his wife helped with respect to the adoption papers and so on. And the time came when this preacher had to bury his own father. 2 hours before this preacher was to preach the funeral service of his father, this son phoned up and said, So-and-so, speaking his wife's name, we want to see you. We want to see you in the motel in 2 hours. This preacher went hoping that the increasing distance would be addressed and taken care of, because this time the son and wife and the mother-in-law had moved to California, but the son and his wife had come back for the funeral of the son's grandfather. So this preacher and his wife went with anticipation to the motel room 2 hours before he's supposed to preach his father's funeral. They sat there, and the son said, we need you to understand that we have made a final decision. This is the final and absolute break. When we finish with this funeral, we never want to see our faces again as long as we live. Don't write. Don't send cards. Don't send birthday gifts to your adopted grandson. We never want to hear from you again. Blessed are the peacemakers. This preacher said that day when his son disowned him and the siblings, it was just one child. The other children are fine. Same daddy, but some influence turned this son against his father. He said, the worst day of my life. My son says he never wants any contact with us again. And 2 hours later, I preach my father's funeral. 5 days after the funeral was over, he sat down and wrote a letter and begged his son and said, I know I was too busy. And by the way, the son had been writing critical, nasty letters back from California. And the father said, I'd seen some preachers who were unwilling to take criticism, and I made up my mind I would accept criticism because I didn't want to get hard and brittle. So he said, every time our son sent a letter criticizing me as a father and a preacher, I thanked him, and I tried to grow from the criticisms of my son. But on that fifth day after the funeral, he wrote a letter and saying he would do anything to repair the breach. And he has a file folder. That was 35 years ago. He has never once seen the face of his son, his daughter-in-law, or the adopted grandchild. 35 years. And he has a file folder. He has a file folder of letters. He's never sent to honor his son's request. Joseph believed that God could mend relationships. And if I'm correct, and this was the same old Potiphar, all right. If you want me to serve by helping these two VIPs, I will. He gets over with his brothers. He's firm. But not to seek vengeance, to test and see if there's necessary growth. Now look, is there someone you need to reconcile with? How can you go on pretending that you want to study for the ministry, Christian school teaching, missions? Evangelist, how can you go on without at least trying? I've had, I think, one person refuse me in 53 years of preaching. One person refuse an attempt at reconciliation. I'm no hotshot, but I'll say this. He who is ready for the healing of relationships broadens life's horizons immeasurably. Because if you're not about trying to heal relationships, your world would just get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And if you don't at least try to heal relationships, at some point you'll look around and you'll have fussed without reconciliation with just about everyone. We cut ourselves off from potential blessing and growth when we don't at least try to reconcile. And I think I suppose some folks call it softness. I just think it's the Christ-like thing to do. Try to be reconciled with people. We had a situation many years ago. I was pretty green in those days. And a family looked good. A family looked really good. And yes, they had money. More money, all of them put together, than the rest of us lower class people had. So they came. They liked very strong conservative preaching. And they gave Jane and I gifts and all that. But after the son of the matriarch ruled the whole thing. It was Mama. Grandpa was henpicked, said nothing. He was just so easy to get along with. But Grandma was the matriarch, and she had her son and her son-in-law in the palm of her hand. And if another lady in the church made a set of drapes, Grandma would criticize and go in at 2 a.m. and take the drapes down and home to make the drapes suit her standard. None of us suited them. And it was about to crack me up. And we had a revival team come. They've changed a lot, but they were different in those days. I got convicted because we just couldn't take it anymore. And we said, you can't go on this way. We can't take it. So they left the church. And in the midst of that revival, I said to the deacons, we need to try one more time. And so three of the deacons volunteered, and I bought a dozen red roses. And we went back into Waterloo. The church campus was a little bit outside the city. We went in and knocked on their door, and they didn't know we were coming. But we walked in, and they quickly arranged a circle of chairs, and we talked. And I basically said, the church can't change. You're so perfectionistic. You're hurting feelings. You're just like bulls in the china shop. You're just tearing everything up and causing deep wounds. We can't change. But in this whole process, I got better, and I'm sorry. And we gave them the roses, and we got on our knees and prayed. And then we left. And I went back and told the revivalist what had happened. He said, now, all right, David, don't you keep pushing on this thing. He said, if you overdo this, yes, you, he said, if you crawl, and yes, sir, how high? He said, yes, you'll get them back in the church, but it'll split again, only much worse than the first time. They did not come back, but when I was up there a few years ago, the son came back to visit the church and took me out for supper, and you'd never know that anything had happened. Now, they still were philosophically not healthy for that church. But friends, we've got to try. We've got to try to reconcile. Maybe it's a dorm issue. I don't know. And I'm going to stop, but I just want to stop here and pray for this 97-year-old preacher's son. It will take a miracle after 35 years of no communication. But wouldn't it be wonderful? I mean, the son still claims to be a Christian, a softer evangelical. Wouldn't it be wonderful if God could do a miracle before this dear man leaves this life? Lord, it would just break my heart. It would break my heart. if our son ever said or did anything like that, I just pray that you do a miracle and give this dear, respected preacher, known for integrity and being a straight shooter from coast to coast, please, Lord, give him the answer to his prayers and help his son to want to reconcile and his daughter-in-law. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I'm going to wrap up here, but just a couple more things. Go over to chapter 41. Chapter 41, verse 45. 41, verse 45. Time has passed. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah, and he gave him to wife Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, priest of On. And Joseph went out all over the land of Egypt. Now, there's more in this verse than would meet the eye with just a quick cursory reading. And here's the practical application from verse 45. The hand of God can keep a man in spite of his being surrounded by a pagan culture or environment. This was mind warfare here. Pharaoh was no dummy. He wanted to completely absorb Joseph into Egyptian culture and Egyptian paganism. You say, well, how do you know that? I know that because the woman that the politician gave to his governor for a wife just happened to be the daughter of the priest of the sun god. Now, is there any closer relationship on earth than the conjugal husband-wife relationship? I think not. If anyone can get to me, it's my wife. All she has to do is smile and I melt. This politician gave this godly young man a pagan wife of the pagan priest of the sun god to change him. Pharaoh wanted to empty Yahweh, get Jehovah out of there, and get the sun god in there. You talk about an inside job. Marriage will do it. This was supposed to be an inside job. On was a city 20 miles away on the east side of the Nile River. And it was the city of Heliopolis, which was a center for the worship of the god Ra. So, do you, Joseph, take Asenath to be your lawful? I know, they didn't use our vows. But he took her to wife and was living with paganism. Remember how Solomon's brides greatly influenced him? Solomon does not end well. And the multiplication of pagan brides was a big part of the fall. And it was sort of ecumenical worship. We'll keep a temple for Jehovah, but let's set up some other statues to this wife's God, and that wife's God, and the other wife's God. And pretty soon Solomon was so mixed up spiritually, he didn't know what end was up. And died a very disillusioned, backslidden Jew. But I want you to see that Joseph did not succumb to this subtle brainwashing, even when it came dressed in the skirts of the conjugal relationship. Well, you say, how do you know that? Well, I know that because of what we see when we go down to verse 50. And unto Joseph were born two sons before the years of the famine came, which Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bare unto him. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God said, he hath made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. And the name of the second called he Ephraim, for God hath caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. You say, David, what's the deal? The deal is that the names of the two sons are Hebrew, Yahweh, Jewish names, not sun god pagan names. Joseph loved Asenath. He was like I should be, like every Christian husband here should be. He led her. And when it came to the naming of their sons, she said, okay, honey, we'll not name them after the sun god. We'll give them monotheistic Yahweh names, Manasseh and Ephraim. He led her. You say, do you think she was ever saved? I have no way of knowing. I know this. He was a gentle but firm leader of the household and said, honey, we'll call them by these names. So, the worship of Jehovah not only survived, it thrived in the naming of the two boys. I'm going to stop with just maybe three sentences about two things. The name Manasseh, God has caused me to forget. And I understand there's a difference of opinion. Some say we can't ever forget him. And that's fine. If that's how they see it, that's fine. We can't ever forget. But Joseph said he forgot, right? God has caused me to forget. And the Apostle Paul said, what? Forgetting those things that are behind. I press toward the mark. So apparently, both Joseph and Paul believed that by the grace of God, you can forget at least some things. Now, you say, I can't forget. Well, at least then you don't have to keep regurgitating and just chewing it over all the time. Certain sights or sounds may bring it back, but you don't have to wallow in it. Joseph did not wallow. He said, God has helped me to forget. And students, I doubt that all of you come from solid Christian homes. Whoever has something happened in the past that you'd be far better to just forget. You won't help it by keeping it alive and just like that old cow chewing it over and over and over again. And Joseph named the second son Ephraim. God's made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. God's given me fruit where it hurt the most. Someone said, your greatest ministry will lie at the point of your deepest hurt. That's because you'll know by experience that hurt, and you'll be able to help others. God has made me Ephraim. He's made me fruitful in the very land of my affliction. Please, please, don't carry all these things. They'll crimp your ministry. People you try to witness to will sense something. They won't know exactly, but if you need to reconcile with a parent, even a parent. And we're not justifying sin. If it wasn't sin, it wouldn't need to be forgiven. Please try to reconcile with those with whom you need to. And put up a sign, Manessa, in your life. God has caused me to forget. And then God can raise the other sign, Ephraim. He's made me fruitful in the land of my affliction.